This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. There's another Kennedy entering politics, this time at the state level, right here in Connecticut. Pro-gun activists rallied this weekend at the Capitol. And you know the smooth jams your favorite pub plays in the background while you eat? Well, they might not have paid for the license to play you that music. Those are just a few of the stories we'll consider this week on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. But first, we're going to start with some amazing news out of Nashville.
UConn sweeps the men's and women's finals for the second time. And once again, scores Connecticut is the center of the college basketball universe.
That's the sound from ESPN of the UConn women winning their record 9th national title last night, capping off a two-day coronation of both the men and women as the best basketball teams in the country. Kevin Ollie's Husky men beat Kentucky Monday night to win their 4th overall title and his first after taking over from Jim Calhoun. Today we'll consider what this means for the school as a sports powerhouse, but also what place UConn holds in our state. Does success in sports allow us to overlook other shortcomings? Have we become too sports-centric, or should we just relax a bit and enjoy the excitement of another winning season? In just a bit, you can join us with your thoughts on that, but I want to welcome in our panelists, including our regular panelists here. Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good to see you as always, Colin, and thank you for hosting The Wheelhouse last week.
Oh, it was my honor. Thank you, Mr. Dankosky.
And Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Paz.
And I'm their irregular panelist.
Irregular panelist. Another irregular panelist is Dan Haar, who writes for The Hartford Current. Hello there, Danny. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. So let's talk UConn basketball for just a little bit, and this should be interesting, Colin, because this has been going on over the course of the last several days, and honestly, probably for the last several years. If we write something negative about UConn in any sphere, having to do with academics, having to do with how much somebody gets paid, people immediately jump to UConn's defense. When we say something nice about UConn, like how good the basketball teams are, other people say, "Wait, UConn's doing all these terrible things." There's a culture of sexual aggression on campus. There are huge problems. We shouldn't be celebrating sports the way we are. How do you feel about all this?
Well, I think you just summed up the sort of the confusion about it all. I do think, Ecclesiastes said there's a time to celebrate basketball victories and then a time to examine internal problems with your university. That may not be the exact wording of Ecclesiastes, but it's pretty close. And so there's a time for everything. And I think it's appropriate right now to be happy about all this. It's appropriate to celebrate the men's victory, particularly to the extent that it really does represent kind of an underdog victory. The women's victory obviously is part of this long chain of 21st century triumphalism that's it's complicated for the team, too. And I don't know, you can't blame Gino Auriemma for this, but it's getting a little boring. And last night, just flipping back and forth. I mean, I couldn't even stay with the game after a while because it's just so embarrassingly lopsided. It's two undefeated teams, but they are not equal teams. In some ways, the victory last night is a great thing for Gino's program. It's also a real problem. It's a problem for women's basketball that this much-heralded clash of titans was so incredibly lopsided.
Paz, what do you think about all this? I mean, are we making too much of this? Do we make too little of the fact that this has become this amazing basketball powerhouse?
No, I think it is duly celebrated, and we will certainly see it celebrated, if not this weekend, then soon. Let's just have fun with it. I mean, there are plenty of other opportunities to look at the shortcomings of UConn as an institution, of looking at the controversy over how the school responded to sexual assaults, to look at, the academic progress of the men's basketball team. It's a cool year. I mean, the best line I saw last night was somebody who tweeted along the lines of, UConn women end UConn's 24-hour title drought.
which is true. And again, maybe it's getting a little old, Dan, but for people around these parts, especially big UConn Husky fans, big basketball fans, this is, again, this state being at the top of the mountain. It's our professional sports franchise. We don't have any others, and so people root for it all the time. What do you make of all this?
Well, hopefully we can talk about it as a true professional sport when we get to a discussion perhaps about that. But I would go a step further and say that any problems that the state and the university have are made better by the success of the programs, not worse. It's a little bit like inequality of income and the super rich. Do you feel better when Eddie Lampert, the $10 billion hedge fund owner, goes south to Florida when he moves south? Well, income just got more equal. It's the same thing. Would you really feel better with the problems that UConn does or doesn't have be better with not a championship? Of course not. So the championship is great, and it can only help, and it actually can help directly.
Well, that's
not such a good – that's a great thing.
Well, it can help directly, but this gets to a conversation we've had for years, Colin, which is the University of Connecticut some couple of decades ago decided when it was building its basketball program that it was going to start to market itself as a sports school that was unrivaled, at least in basketball. And then the women started winning, the men started winning, and we end up with a place where it seems like sports calls a lot of the shots. We're not the only state where the two top basketball coaches are the top paid employees in the state, but it certainly does feel as though basketball is king around here. Do we make too much of sports as part of what we care about in our university setting?
Well, I mean, spending on athletics goes up, spending on academics goes down. That's a nationwide trend at colleges. So it's a problem, absolutely. I think one of the things that Dan is suggesting, and not incorrectly, there was a great piece by Steve Eder from the New York Times on Monday about Susan Herbst and the fact that she, as president of UConn, is jetting around to these various championship games accompanied by the top 1% donors. And, of course, it's so easy to raise money from these people at these games. Their brains are just this huge stew of endorphins. You know, they're like, so it's really easy to raise money from somebody who's really happy. So in terms of raising money for the university, that's great. And in terms of the profile of the university, that's great. And in terms of the kinds of things that Herbst is aiming at, it's all great. The one question that sort of sits over on the sidelines of a conversation like this one is UConn a place that you would want to send your kid right now for 4 years? And I think that's sort of a separate question. And I think it's a less easy to answer question. If your kid wasn't comfortable with a hyper-charged sports culture, if that wasn't something that your kid cared about, if you're interested in having your kid get, you know, a good solid liberal arts education or whatever your goal is for your kid, is that exactly where you want him to be right now? Personally, I wouldn't send my kid to UConn right now. I'm very happy about all the things that it's appropriate to be happy about, but I'm not comfortable with an on-campus situation. If I had a sensitive 17, 18-year-old kid, I wouldn't be aiming him or her at UConn.
And once again, we saw, as happens in a lot of these situations, a bit of minor, we'll say, rioting or major celebrations after the men's victory. This always happens, Paz. There's a bunch of arrests on campus. Some things are knocked over. People don't comport themselves that terribly well. Colin's talking about a culture on campus that maybe is charged by this sports culture. What do you think?
I hate to admit that when the men's game ended, one of the first thoughts I had was, I wonder how bad it will be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do get conditioned by this. Look, we're talking about 18, 19, 20-year-olds who when you have mobs of people, bad things happen. When you have mobs of teenagers, really stupid things happen. So I don't know if that's a specific reflection on UConn as it is on a broader demographic, shall we say.
And we also understand that there was quite a bit of rioting on Kentucky's campus after they lost. Sometimes people riot when you win, and sometimes people riot when you lose. In this particular case, it happened a bit on both campuses. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266, as we're talking about the championships for both the men and the women. Let's talk about some of the specifics here. And, Paz, as you said, 19, 20-year-olds, sometimes they do things, they say things that maybe you wish they didn't say. Here's a little bit from the celebration. The star guard for the UConn Huskies, the man who, more than anyone else, willed them to this victory, Shabazz Napier, speaking after their win.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at the Hungry Huskies. This is what happens when you ban us. Last year, 2 years, we worked so hard for it. 2 years and hungry. Hungry Huskies.
So, Colin, I'd like you to weigh in on this because you've written quite a bit about Shabazz. This is a complicated character and someone who honestly, again, led his team to this victory, was part of the 2011 victory, said some things there that people may take some issue with. Certainly around the ban of the program from the tournament over its academic non-success.
Yeah, I'm sort of going to go from my usual role as withering critic of the UConn Husky program to apologist on this one. He was accused of going Richard Sherman. I think that was USA Today's claim. You know, I just think this is being misunderstood. And I think if you listen carefully to what he's saying is because we got banned, we worked even harder. We had 2 years in the desert, so to speak, in order to put ourselves in the kind of mindset that we were in to win this thing. Because this really was, this was not the most talented basketball team in the tournament. This was a triumph of will, I think. And, you know, I'm willing to cut Napier quite a bit of slack in a situation like this. It must have been very frustrating to be banned last year for problems that weren't his. I mean, he's actually an academic performer. He's going to graduate in good standing. So, I mean, he was kept out of the tournament last year for a situation that he had nothing to do with creating. It must have been a very frustrating thing. And I think you were hearing that. And sort of, once again, that idea is, yeah, we got hungry. You starved us last year. We got hungry. Here we are. We're the champions. I think that was the point of that. And, you know, I mean, Dan does want to get into this whole question of I think the sort of the professionalizing of athletes. One of the things that was in the Connecticut Mirror this week was Napier talking about how he was literally hungry a lot of the time. He literally didn't have enough food because of just the way this whole thing is set up. You get a full boat scholarship, but you don't necessarily, you know, have enough money to feed yourself. He's a kid from he and Boatwright are both sons of single mothers, and you know, they don't show up at the school with a lot of the spending money that maybe, you know, our kids would.
Yeah. Dan?
Well, I first want to get just quickly back to the issue of sports culture at UConn, which is the overarching thing we're talking about. And I would question whether because UConn is winning more, that becomes more of a sports culture. The sports culture has already been there, has always been there, has never been any more or less than it is now. Just when we win, it becomes more evident. And so I wouldn't hesitate to send a kid to UConn. If anything, it's gotten a lot more certainly it's more selective than it had been, if that's some indication of how good the place is to send a sensitive 17-year-old. And as far as the pay and the players, we have a ridiculous situation in which they're working essentially 60 to 65 hours a week in a job, and they're not getting paid for it. A union is an equally ridiculous solution. It's stupid, and it doesn't make sense. Unfortunately, this is what you get when you have a sort of an entrenched hegemony that refuses to see the way that people live in the real world.
Well, what's the better solution?
The better solution is to pay them a stipend that's a livable wage, that without a union and you know, with all this nonsense about crossing the lines to professionalism, because they're working in jobs for 60 hours a week.
One of the things that we've heard recently is what happened with the Olympics years ago. They used to be amateur athletes. And then after a time, it became obvious that they were professional athletes. They were allowed to make endorsement money, and they made quite a bit from endorsement money. Is that part of it, just allowing Shabazz Napier, who's hot right now, to, you know, get his face on a box of Wheaties while he's an undergraduate?
No, I don't think so. I don't know that that would be a travesty for American culture, but I don't think that's the right way to go. They are still amateurs, and you pay them an amateur stipend to do essentially a job that they're doing in which they're presumably making money for the university, although some enterprising reporter is going to prove that they spent more money than they made this year. And that's, I would say, the way to go.
Paz, what do you think?
You know, there's a middle ground here, and the NCAA rules on this stuff can be ridiculous. You know, they're blind to some of the things that really outrage people. But if a coach gives a player $10 to go to McDonald's at 10 o'clock because he's hungry again, that's a violation. And I have to admit, I was one of the people when I heard him talking about going to bed hungry. You know, I kind of snickered. And then I thought about it. It's like, well, okay, my kids went to college with spending money because they have time to work and earn. These kids don't. And, you know, the meal times there are, you know, fairly rigid. And, you know, we know how many calories a 21-year-old male, much less one who's an elite athlete, can burn up. My colleague, Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, who wrote about it, you know, she had looked around and she said there have been a lot of incidents like this of people saying, you know, the system doesn't work for us. We, you know, if you don't have the extra $20 in your pocket to go out and get that pizza at 10 o'clock because you're hungry again. It is a problem.
Well, and it's one of the things, Colin, before we take a few phone calls at 860-275-7266, that you wrote a very nice piece in your blog about Kevin Ollie, the new coach of UConn, the way he banded this team together. And it's one of the reasons why I come down on the side of not growing up here in Connecticut, not being a UConn sports fan by birthright, but rooting for this team. It is a collection of stories like Shabazz Napier's. kids who have worked very hard at what they're very good at and overcome quite a lot to band together as a team and do something to both represent themselves and also the community at large. They really are, in many ways, representing the best in terms of how you work at something as a collective to do something that's important. And Kevin Ollie, someone who was a UConn star by birthright, someone who is a part of this sports culture, he seemed to band them together in a much different way than we had with the previous coach.
Yeah, and I think that's great. But I think that the things that we're talking about here are really – they're kind of on the table as they never were before, partly because of what happened at Northwestern, but partly because all of these athletes are paying attention. If you look at what Napier said in that Connecticut Mirror interview, he's talking about this – I've never heard a UConn player talk so openly about the idea that maybe a union or something like that is not a bad idea. And, you know, Dan, I'm not 100% convinced that – I mean, that even two of your statements are reconcilable. I mean, if this really is a job – you know, like a 60-hour-a-week job. Most people who have jobs don't get stipends. So a stipend is something you give to somebody to sort of, you know, keep them at bay or keep them sort of comforted a little bit before they get a job. Or it's, you know, for expenses while you're on the road or something like that. I mean, if it's a job, it's a job. Why pay somebody a stipend? And how much is a stipend? And I guess the other question, and I know this is something that you've brought up in the past, John, is the question of, well, does everybody pay the same stipend? Does Gonzaga pay a smaller stipend than Kentucky?
Actually, you know? One model that they're talking about in the private schools, of course, as we know in Connecticut, you would need enabling legislation to even have a union in a public university. But in the private university, they're talking about paying the stars only. And that's a really bad idea because you're dividing a team within itself. But as far as the job goes, maybe the choice of word is wrong. Maybe they have a task in exchange for their scholarship in much the same way that my daughter at the University of Vermont gets a certain amount of financial aid, and she's a music major. No, she's not, you know, I'm not putting her on the same pedestal by any means. But, you know, there is at all things for all people an exchange. And this is just a higher and more public exchange.
We're talking with Dan Haar of the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Here's what we're going to do. Let's take a break. When we come back, our friend Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University will join us. And we'll get to some of these phone calls about the University of Connecticut. Before we move on to other topics, we're tackling the week's news here on The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're starting our program talking about UConn's amazing victories in both men's and women's basketball. Some people say we're making too much of it. Other people say that we're not making enough of it. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let's quickly go to Michelle in Southbury to start the conversation off. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hey, John. Great to be on the phone with this amazing panel this morning. I don't think we're making enough of it in this state. What these Huskies have accomplished is an absolute inspiration to me. I'm a sensitive intellectual in the suburbs here in Connecticut, and every single year I am just amazed at how hard these kids work and how hard they fight to achieve something. And I think there's a big lesson for all of us in really putting ourselves out there. I don't think they get enough support. The idea that one of these guys is hungry is stunning.
Well, Michelle, first of all, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Steve on the cell phone. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. What's up?
Man, hey, I just was listening from the beginning here, and I'm glad you guys are celebrating the basketball victories. But I just have to comment, it seemed like you were
And Steve, I'm sorry, I'm losing you a little bit because your cell phone is breaking up. But I think I get your point. You're saying we're unable to come up with positive things to say about the University of Connecticut. I may have Colin address that in a moment, but I'd like to bring in Kalila Brown-Dean, who's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Welcome back, Kalila. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
me. And you've been listening to a little bit of this conversation. How do you take all this? I mean, we're being critical of the university in part because we are critical of the university as part of our jobs, whether it's academic success, whether or not it's the culture there, and other things. We're also praising the university for amazing athletic accomplishments. How do you think we strike this balance?
Well, I think it's an amazing achievement for both the men's and women's teams, but I think we also have to look at the bigger picture. Yesterday was Equal Pay Day in this country because women tend to make less per dollar than men. So add to the layer of Title IX, which requires gender equity in colleges. How is this going to impact that? If we start saying we're going to reward student athletes based on the amount of money they generate for the school, based on their championships, what will that mean for women's teams and for women's sports? And we already see in this state colleges that have not complied with Title IX and are now facing an economic shortfall. What will that mean for students who have to suffer a tuition increase in the fall? So it's easier to say, yes, these students should be compensated. But when we talk about implementation, we may create bigger problems that we've not yet addressed.
And creating bigger problems with women's athletics, which at the University of Connecticut, at least in women's basketball, are strong, have been sustaining, and as we've said, almost lopsidedly lapping the field when it comes to women's basketball. In a lot of places, women's sports programs are underfunded. They're often cut along with Olympic-level men's sports. This is something that goes on all over the place while we celebrate big football and basketball national titles.
Incredibly. And even if we look beyond basketball at UConn, what other programs would we see that same level of achievement that we would think those student athletes should be compensated for? And what would it mean for them to be in a union and have very different requirements about not just being an athlete at the university, but a student and balancing all of that? So it has to be more than just how much money can we give them. It's really about what the contribution will be overall.
First of all, that's a really great point, and I haven't really heard anybody else make it as part of this
practicalities.
Debate. Yeah, it's a really great point. I guess for a lot of people, I think the other part of this is, though, granting everything that you just said, I don't dispute a word of it, that a lot of people look at the sheer amount of money that is generated for other people by the sweat of these athletes, mm-hmm. you know, to the point where even the ladder that the coach climbs to cut down the net is a piece of product placement that the ladder company is paying somebody a lot of money for. So the coaches make a lot of money. The NCAA makes a lot of money. The university makes a lot of money. There's a lot of money, you know, and it's just not going to the people who, I mean, just almost had a sort of, you know, Marxist critique of it. It's just not going to the people who are doing the really hard work.
Well,
and there's something that seems fundamentally wrong with that.
Beyond just the hyper-commercialism that Colin just mentioned, I mean, there are stories, memes coming out about the fact that you couldn't get a water bottle or a cup of soda into the arenas without the official NCAA logo, and this is a big piece of it. Danny Hart, I wasn't going to talk about my trip to Augusta, Georgia this weekend, but I'm going to. I went to go see the Masters with my dad, and we got rained out a little bit. It's a long story. I won't get into it. Here's one thing about the Masters. They have so much money. They have such control over this American iconic sports event that there's no commercialism anywhere. Everything just says the Masters, and it doesn't even say that much. You have $1.50 concessions at the concession stand. You have civility and you have cleanliness, and it's all wonderful. What comes with that, though, is a long history of not treating African Americans and not treating women very well. It's another trade-off in American society. There's no commercialism, because they don't have to be commercial, but instead they've acted badly in some other ways.
Well, the Masters is a great tradition, and by the way, they do get a whole bunch of money from, I believe, Cadillac for those, you know, really careful placements. And is it Travelers as well?
There's a few big ones. It's actually a tradition unlike any other.
I'll probably be charged money for saying that. But the Masters is not a great example of a utopian form of economic culture in our society.
Exactly.
As you said, but not necessarily for the reason that you said it. The issue here is that the Masters is able to do that because it's highly, highly endowed. Right. And so there's no economic system that rose up and created this as something other than an exclusionary system.
But all of these top sports universities are highly endowed as well. They have made millions upon millions upon millions. The student athletes aren't paid, and yet they're able to make more millions every single year through endorsement deals that come on top of one another.
I'm no fan of the NCAA and the way they treat the rules and the athletes. But I think you have to separate a system that is exclusionary at its core from a system that's trying to be inclusionary but can't figure out the way to allocate resources. What we have here in basketball and in big-time sports in colleges is an allocation problem. We don't have a problem with the system. There's nothing necessarily wrong, I don't think, with having big-time sports because, as I said before, we already have big-time sports. The issue is now we're winning. And now it's making money.
Well,
there's nothing wrong with money.
Kalila, you teach at a university that didn't used to have big-time sports.
Right.
And it's getting more big-time all the time. Mm-hmm. Quinnipiac University gets into the men's hockey finals mm-hmm. last year. They're building new facilities. They're Division I in many, many sports. Have you seen the changes over time on your campus with a more of a sports focus, sports culture?
Well, I think you definitely see students becoming much more involved, much more engaged, the university being known more for that achievement. But I think if you look at the level of support that's offered to student athletes at a place like Quinnipiac versus UConn or my alma mater, The Ohio State University, it's a very different expectation. Students know why they are there and they are expected to perform in that way. I think the part of it that we're not talking about is how universities fail those student athletes. You know that less than one half of 1% will make it into the pros. So as a university, you have an obligation to prepare them for life after athletics. And many we see that at UNC, right? A student turns in an essay that's essentially a paragraph and gets an A for that. That's not an isolated event. So we can talk about the finance, but we also have to talk about the expectation of students.
We are getting some emails here. I think that the stipend idea is a good one. I'm a professional musician. When I went to graduate school, I earned a stipend as a member of a performing ensemble. This is common in the world of music, and I think the comparison to sports is appropriate. There's a lot more to talk about, obviously, around this issue. Congratulations to the men and women of UConn. And we're going to move on in our conversation here on The Wheelhouse, on Where We Live, as we're talking about the news of the week. Kalila Brown-Dean is our guest from Quinnipiac University. Dan Harris from the Hartford Current. Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Kalila, we read with some interest a short piece that you wrote, an op-ed piece for the New York Times about the death penalty, something that is really coming back into our consciousness again for a couple different reasons here in Connecticut. But first of all, why don't you outline what you wrote to the newspaper? Because once again, it's a very important issue, one that we don't talk about very much here in Connecticut, except sometimes around political campaigns. What do you have to say?
So the piece is really about this idea of justice. What does justice look like and for whom is justice served by the death penalty? And my piece was really coming from the perspective of someone who is a family member of a person who was murdered and the realization that there are racial disparities within our system of capital punishment in terms of which crimes are considered most heinous, which lives most vulnerable, and what that means for really serving families and dismantling the idea that capital punishment is about justice for victims. It's really about justice for particular victims.
Justice for particular victims, meaning that, first of all, people don't get sentenced to death for killing African Americans. Many African Americans are sentenced to death around the United States. Something
right.
here in Connecticut, of course, that we have to think about is we for a long time had a death penalty, people on death row. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we have a repeal of that mm-hmm. moving forward, although we still have people on death row. How do you think this whole argument plays out here in Connecticut, a blue state that has essentially rejected the death penalty as an idea?
Well, I think that what we saw in Connecticut and what we're seeing increasingly nationwide is that it's a system that is irreparably broken. The fact that you have people who linger on death row for decades. We've only executed one person in this state, and that was a person who volunteered for that execution, who said no more, no more appeals, no more dragging the family through this. And if we can't protect people who are innocent. We know there was a person in Louisiana last week who was released from death row after 30 years and discovering that he was in fact innocent. If we cannot address those problems, I don't think that the state should be taking anyone's life, not just in terms of privileging which lives matter, but also creating a system that is fair and is actually doing what it's supposed to do.
I would agree with everything you said about the equity of the death penalty, except in your essay where you said that there should be a federal solution. And I think as to use your words about sports, that could bring more problems than it solves because we don't have the ability to create, for example, budgets at the federal level, let alone social policy.
So one sort of minor counter to that, I wasn't saying there should be a federal solution. What I was saying is that federalism shouldn't decide whether, you know, my life is more valued in this state or another. So I believe that states should be able to determine what they view as acceptable. But the idea that taxes accounts for nearly 70% of everyone executed in this country, that's a problem to me.
Yes.
It's hard to ever think there's justice in a crime and a punishment that are always going to be statistical outliers. And there's always the question of why was that murder rise to the level that the perpetrator was going to get the death penalty as opposed to others? Even the way the most restrictive laws are written, you know, what are the aggravating factors? I think to people whose loved ones are killed and they don't meet that checklist, it's offensive. It's always going to be offensive. And that's always, I think, where a discussion of the death penalty sort of circles back to. It's a very important debate. You know, it is the ultimate punishment. It's the ultimate power of the state. But it's an argument that revolves around an incredible minority of cases, which advocates of repeal have often pointed to as saying, why are we expending so much political capital, moral capital,
and money,
a lot of money for each one of these cases.
And Connecticut is a state to the extent people believe in the death penalty. They do it well. You get first-class representation. You do not have the horror stories here that you have in some other states. I don't believe there's any doubt about the guilt of anyone on death row in Connecticut for that reason. But again, it comes down to a whole lot of time, effort, and money on an incredible minority of cases.
I think the problem extends well beyond the court system. I think it's a huge social problem for us as well, and I think Connecticut's a great place to talk about it. Connecticut, where everybody knows everything about the Pettit case and nobody knows anything about any other murder case. You probably could not get most people to tell you the name of a murder victim that was not – and I'm not – obviously – I mean, the Pettit thing was horrible, and my heart goes out to the survivors, and just a dreadful thing. But it really isn't the only murder that ever happened in Connecticut. And one of the problems is that we almost accept as a society murder in urban environments as this kind of low, steady hum. You know, we don't know too much about it. We know there are people there. They're probably of color. Some of them are little kids, you know. I mean, Kayshawn Roberson died pretty much the way the Pettit girls did, from an arson of asphyxiation. He was 8 years old, lived in New Haven. B.J. Brown was 8 years old. He was killed because it might have been a witness to another shooting by Russell Peeler. These are names that people don't know. And so the problem is with the media to a certain degree. I mean, there are certain things that kind of sell at the level of ratings and clicks on websites and stuff like that. And I think the problem also is just, you know, go look in the mirror. I mean, for some reason or another, we've decided only to care about certain murders.
We're talking on the Wheelhouse about the week's news here on Where We Live. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Another issue coming up in this year's election, once again, gun laws enacted after the Newtown school shootings. Now, Dan Haar, members of the gun rights community rallied at the state capitol over this past weekend. This is something you've been following about the gun lobby, the anti-gun lobby since Newtown. What do we see new this past weekend?
Well, one of the things we saw is that the political presence of a minority, an admitted minority of in policy, that is the Second Amendment rights people, understand that the majority of citizens in Connecticut favor the gun rights. The Quinnipiac poll was 57%. There was a much higher percentage who generally favor restrictions. And they're going to make themselves heard this fall in elections. And where there are elections that are close, there could be a very significant difference. For example, in the governor's race, he only won by 6,000 votes the last time. He obviously is way out front on this. It's very clear that the populace supports the bill that he pushed in April of 2013, but it could also have an effect on the margins. And so both sides could essentially be right. And I think the rally this year was much more about politics and activism than last year was about anger.
What do we know about Tom Foley, the leading Republican candidate, and his stance on the gun laws that were passed last year?
He wants it known that he's a friend of gun owners, but beyond that, he won't really say what that means. He is not – asked specifically, he is not for repealing or even revising the post-Newtown gun laws. So he, I think he's trying to set himself up as their choice by default. The entrance of Martha Dean into the Republican race has changed the dynamic there in a number of ways.
And may very well force Tom Foley to have conversations about this issue in a way that he hasn't previously.
And he's, I think, smartly trying not to, because whichever way you step here, there's danger. The gun issue in certain districts under certain circumstances, I think, can be decisive. Statewide, I'm not so sure.
Kalila?
Well, I think it's going to be a very expensive race. I think there's going to be a lot of money flowing into these campaigns on this issue. And, you know, Dean has made it very clear where she stands. And I don't think that her opponents can afford not to address it head on. Is this the single defining issue that we want to be for the state? Some people say yes. But I think in the grand scheme of things, there is a way to, you know, not address it directly and still come out ahead.
Colin?
Worst case scenario for on the Republican side, I think, is that Dean sucks up all of the support from gun rights people, doesn't survive the convention. She says she's not going to primary. I don't happen to believe that. But doesn't survive whatever process ultimately results in the nomination of Tom Foley or somebody else. And then the gun rights people get mad and go home and stay home and don't vote in the election. That, if you were a Republican strategist, is a scenario you would like to avoid.
We're going to take a break now, and I will just end this segment with a quick thought about this. One of the conversations that happened after Newtown was that guns aren't the entire problem. There's mental health problems and other things. I came in just before this show to news that there's a stabbing at a Pennsylvania high school. Dozens potentially of kids were stabbed. There's a suspect in custody. He's a male student. Seven victims have life-threatening injuries. As of right now, there have been no fatalities in that stabbing. It's a stabbing. It's not a shooting. It happens to have happened at the high school that I went to in Murrysville, Pennsylvania. So it's something that I'm watching very closely, and we will be watching throughout the course of the day. And, of course, this afternoon on All Things Considered here on WNPR. When we come back, maybe talking a bit more about campaign finance. Kennedy gets back into politics, and we'll talk about some other things as well. Coming up on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, if you watch House of Cards on Netflix, you might have noticed there's a main storyline around a bridge that would run from Long Island to Connecticut. Sounds crazy, right? Here's the thing. It was a real idea with blueprints and everything. We'll take a look at bridges, highways, malls, some fairly outlandish projects that never got built for some reason or another. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today on the program, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking, as always, with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on tap this afternoon, Colin?
And now I'm wondering whether the bridge to the 21st century ever got built. We heard a lot about that for a while. On the show today, it's a long-form conversation with Thomas More. You remember him from the book Care of the Soul. He's done a lot of other books since then. We have Double Barrel. We already taped it. It's a really interesting conversation, if I dare say so myself. We have Double Barrel Action. Tonight we'll be at Watkinson School if you want to talk more about sports, but kind of more about some of the negative sides of sports, some of the things that we get wrong as a culture about sports. We have a forum called Whatever Happened to the Field of Dreams. It's at Watkinson School at 7 p.m.
More people can come and criticize you about how you talk about sports.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be great. It'll be an interesting conversation, as always, at Watkinson with Colin tonight. Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, is here. Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and Dan Haar, who writes for the Hartford Current, is also here as well. Now, last night there was a campaign announcement. This time involves a member of the Kennedy family, Ted Kennedy Jr., widely expected to run for outgoing State Senator Ed Meyer. Last night he announced that he would do so.
I want to bring a common sense and cooperative tone to government. I strongly identify with my father's philosophy of consensus building and bipartisanship. He taught us that you should never be afraid to stand up for your political beliefs. But at the same time, he said, never hesitate to try to find consensus.
We've talked about Ted Kennedy Jr. a number of times in the program, Paz, whether or not he was going to get into politics at some level. Now he's going to go for a state Senate seat held by Ed Meyer. What do you say?
He tried so hard last night to emphasize that he is a candidate for local office, for state office. Yes, he talked about his father. He did not run away from that incredible family legacy. But I had the sense he was taking great pains to kind of tamp things down, that he did not want to his rhetoric stayed away from those wonderful catchphrases that his father had used, the cause endures, the work goes on, that kind of thing. I think he was very conscious of the fact that he needs to be seen as Ted Kennedy from Branford, Connecticut, who is running for the state house and not somebody who's going for his father's seat in the United States Senate.
Should we read more into this than a guy running for a state Senate seat, Kalila?
Well, I think that's really the challenge. I think everyone is discussing what might the long-term strategy be. Will this be sort of the setup to run for Congress? But listening to his emphasis on consensus building and bipartisanship, my immediate response was good luck. Right? That's not really the politics that we have now. So whether he'll be able to do that and navigate that family legacy and that mantle, it'll be interesting.
Well, you know, he spent 30 years with his nose to the grindstone on health advocacy and related issues so that he could say now in 2014 at age 52 that if my name were Ted Smith Jr., you still might vote for me for state Senate. And that might be the case. Probably if his name were Ted Smith Jr., there would be people in line for Ed Meyers' seat ahead of him, certainly for state Senate, maybe not for state rep. He could run for something. But nonetheless, he is a Kennedy. And what we see unfolding before us, as we've seen in generations before, is this great dilemma, this great anguish between, yes, I'm famous, but I don't want you to vote for me because I'm famous. But look at all these famous people around me now. I suspect he's going to regret that he waited quite this long because he's going to perhaps get Rosa DeLauro's seat in 2 years should she decide to retire, work in the U.S. Congress for a number of years, and then age out of being a young senator, which he might have one day been.
Well, Dan's getting maybe a little bit ahead of things, yeah, Colin.
He's planned the guy's whole life for him.
He's an agent. This is
A couple of things to say about this. First of all,
Dan went to Wesleyan, as did Ted Jr. I'll just throw that out.
That's true. You should have got that on the table. First of all, I think he's going to regret the whole TK2 thing, which sounds to me like something that would hurt your hard drive, TK2. It's like I want that kept off. But, the one thing we haven't said so far is that presumably there will be an election. This seat belonged for 14 years to a Republican named Bill Anuskovich, which means that it's not a lock for a Democrat. The demographics may have changed a little bit during the Ed Meyer era. And obviously when you run as a Kennedy, you have sort of – you're hitting off the front tees in certain ways. But, it sort of is the question that we will ask so often during the coming year. Can the Republicans in any given race that we might be talking about get their act together, find a good candidate, and be competitive? They have so much trouble organizing themselves on that level and doing a good job in big races and in small, and this is going to be another one of them.
But before we run low on time, I want to get to something we didn't get a chance to talk about last week on The Wheelhouse because the news came in after the show was over. This big campaign finance ruling from the Supreme Court, it once again opens up this idea of how much money is going to get into politics, essentially stripping away the amount that individuals can give, any sort of limits on that. Colin, what big impact do you think it's going to have on this campaign moving forward in this midterm election year and then past this year?
Well, I haven't thought about this enough, but my sense is that this isn't the thing that's going to have a big impact. First of all, we're talking about 1,219 people fall into this, are currently the maxed out people, the people who could presumably go further under this.
The 0.00001%.
Yeah. So this is a tiny group of people. I mean, what's going to happen in this campaign, third-party expenditures are going to be the story of this campaign, not individual donor limits, but the money, as Kalila was alluding to before, the money that comes in from outside sources, often difficult to account for, very little transparency, that will be the story of this campaign, not what happened with McCutcheon.
Dan?
Yeah, I agree with that. McCutcheon is much smaller a deal than Citizens United because aggregate limits, just to be clear here, what it says is that any one person can now give whatever the base limit to any single politician to as many as he or she wants. And so the limit of corruption is the fact that you're giving it to many different places.
But there's different – there's always a way around this.
There's
ways to bundle and to work together.
This opens up new holes, but we already had holes that we didn't deal with before.
Kalila?
I think it stretches the holes even wider in many ways. And the lack of public knowledge of how these laws really work and what it will mean, particularly for these third-party organizations, I think that's where we need to focus.
Every change in campaign finance rules has unintended consequences. The money goes, it flows like water, different places. It's really hard to know 100% what this will do. Connecticut has one of these limits, I will say, and I couldn't find a case that anybody ever hit it. So on its face, it's a narrow thing. But the bigger question is, how will it be gamed? What angles will develop?
We want to end with this. You might not realize it, but restaurants that play music while you eat have to pay a big price, whether it's off an iPod, the radio, or even a cover band playing. Several local restaurants are in trouble for not paying their royalty fees. Joining us by phone now, Karen Alley, who's a web editor for the Connecticut Law Tribune. Karen, welcome to the show. So what exactly is happening with these restaurants?
Yeah, who knew that restaurants needed a license to play music? We didn't know. And it turns out that people operating restaurants don't seem to know this, at least a lot of them don't. But legally, the playing of music is considered a public performance. It's copyright law, and the person playing it needs a license. And we found that there are many copyright infringement claims against restaurants in Connecticut, some popular ones that we've probably heard of and been visited ourselves. In the last few years, many restaurants have settled or lost court battles over these claims. The licensing organizations that represent artists send out scouts to restaurants and other establishments. It could be retail stores as well, hospitals even, and they try to make sure that if they're playing their music, that they have a license. And if they're playing it and they don't have a license, what they do is they try to work with the restaurant or the retail establishment, try to explain to them that they need one. And I'm told that they work with the restaurants and the other establishments. They don't sue right away. They try to get you to buy a license before suing.
But how expensive are these licenses? I mean, a lot of restaurants, they're playing music off their iPod 24 hours a day. I mean, mm-hmm. How expensive is it?
Yeah, that's a good question. It could be hundreds of dollars. A lawyer from one of the licensing organizations told me. He said it could be hundreds up to thousands. I know a restaurant owner in Shelton paid about $4,500 for one license. It depends on the size of the establishment, how often you're playing the music. That's something the licensing organization will work out with the owner. But yeah, it could be up to thousands, but it could be lower if you're a smaller establishment.
So hold it. If like, I don't know, say Dan Harr was in your restaurant playing cover tunes, playing Van Morrison tunes, you'd have to pay a license fee for that as well as paying Dan Harr?
Dan has an ABBA tribute act. Let's be accurate here.
With costumes.
That's funny. That's a good question. That's a good question. There are some exceptions. If you turn on a radio in a small restaurant or a small retail store, that's an exception and you don't have to pay. But if you start hooking it up to speakers, four speakers or more, then you need to start worrying about getting a license. And there are a few other exceptions as well.
Four speakers or more. It reminds me of something. I was talking earlier about my trip to see my folks down in South Carolina and Georgia and go see mm-hmm. some golf. We wandered by a bar, and we heard a guy playing Tom Petty covers so badly that I couldn't imagine someone could actually say that they were Tom Petty songs. Isn't there any sort of wiggle room here? I mean, there's a lot of creative interpretations, Karen, of music, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. The lawyers were explaining the law to me, and it's very there are some very convoluted loopholes. So you never know. You could get around that one.
Well, we're not going to name some of the restaurants that are in here, but you can certainly take a look on her piece in the Connecticut Law Tribune website. Karen Alley, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
In just the last few seconds, is UConn going to have a parade for both schools down down Main Street in Hartford? What's
Danny
happening?
Actually is organizing it this weekend.
Yes, I was as close to organizing it without crossing the line yesterday as I can be. I've been watching the emails from the governor's office and other offices. We expect an announcement late this morning when the UConn women's team wakes up and declares whether they can or can't be there. Saturday morning is the only time that there's no direct conflict because the Bushnell has events both Sunday and Saturday afternoon, and Sunday morning is Palm Sunday.
Should we have one big, massive parade, Colin?
That's what we did in 2004. It was big and it was massive, and it was fun.
Well, and I hope that Dan Harr is the grand marshal of this parade, if indeed it comes off. I think you should be. After suggesting this, Dan Harr from the Hartford Current, thank you very much for
joining. Someone named Dan will be there.
Dan will be the marshal.
Dan will be there. Mark Bazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, thank you for being here as well. Kalila Brown-Dean, thank you for making the trip
up to see us
from Quinnipiac University. And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Please sue my gym for the music they play. Please.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.